from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was unexpectedly made September 9th, when police were called to a Rochester cemetery. Assemblyman Bill Nojay had gone to a family gravesite, and there he took his own life before an officer could try to stop him. His death shocked the community and his colleagues in the assembly, and it came just days before the Republican primary. Now, voters still voted for Bill Nojay over his primary challenger, Honeoye Falls Mayor Rick Milne. And that threw the election into a bit of chaos, because the law calls for the county chairman then to decide the candidate if the elected winner is no longer alive. The three chairmen decided to put forward former Assemblyman Joe Arrigo. He's someone with a history in office and a name recognition with voters. Democrat Barbara Bayer criticized that process that allowed three county chairmen to get together and decide the candidate. She called it just another version of Albany's much maligned three men in a room. The chairman responded that Joseph Arrigo brings stability to a tumultuous and unexpected situation that we have here. Well, this hour, they are both generous with their time, and we have the ability to welcome both candidates in that assembly district to discuss the issues and what brought them here. So Barbara Bear, the Democrat running for state assembly, nice to see you in studio,
Barbara.
Nice to
see you.
Thank you for
Thank
being
you.
Here. And Joe Arrigo, who is the Republican. He served from 2000 to 2010. And who knows, maybe again. Nice to see you back here, Joe. Thank you.
Well, hopefully that long, so.
Joe, I want to start with you on this because, you know, you go back to before the death of Bill Nojay. Did you think you would ever get back into politics?
No. No, I did not.
Okay. And after his death, well, to the best that you're willing to share here, I just suspect you were shocked like the rest of us. I mean, it was a surreal
No question, because I talked Bill into running for the assembly. And we went back quite a few years because I was one of the commissioners on the Regional Transit Authority, and Bill was also there, and so we had a good relationship.
You knew him well, and
yes.
And so after his death, when was the first time it either came to your attention? Did you volunteer yourself? Did the chairman come to you and say, "Look, we're going to need someone, and you might be the best fit"?
No one approached me really, and I just felt it's incumbent upon myself to go and ask. Something came over me that I wanted to go back and serve.
Okay. And can you share as best you can what it was that convinced you that this is the right thing to do?
Well, again, you know, Bill, I mean, that situation had a real effect on me. And he and I kind of thought, you know, in the same lines. So I wanted to carry on, you know, his thoughts or wishes. So I felt compelled to go back.
Have you missed serving in state government?
The only thing I miss are the people. I know that things have changed, it's not an easy job. You know, it's going to take me away from, you know, my home and my grandchildren, but they understand.
Okay. Well, Barbara, I know you've been criticizing the process that led us here, and you know, I recall having Rick Milne in the studio here before that election. I think he was understandably concerned that if he didn't win that primary, if voters still chose Bill Nojay, that the chairman were not going to select him. And we heard from a lot of listeners who were sort of confused about how the process works. Are you still feeling like the process was either unfair or you had a problem with that?
Well, I think the process was unfair in this sense. This is no reflection on Mr. Arrigo, Assemblyman Arrigo, but this is what I think was wrong, or ironic at least. Bill Nojay, on the day that the budget was passed, put out a huge press release saying that three men in a room had passed the budget, and it was wrong, that there was not any kind of input from the regular Assembly people. And Bill Nojay had traveled all over the world, according to his own resume, working on fair and independent elections. So my problem was there was a candidate who was still available. And what the party bosses did was to make robocalls and say, vote for the dead person. That seemed to me to be that they wanted control of who was picked, which to me is not the most democratic process. I'm not saying a law was violated, but I don't think
sure. It
was appropriate.
No, I mean, I think very clearly the law in this case was not violated. You just think that maybe it should be changed going forward. And the chairman aren't here, but let me try to at least kind of channel some of what they've said. What they have said is, we urged people to vote for Mr. Nojay because we thought he best represented the values of the district. And that, you know, if they felt that way about Rick Milne, they would have said vote for Rick Milne. They did not. And one of the arguments I hear, Barbara, is, look, if someone who is recently deceased still ends up winning an election, maybe it says that the person who's running against him shouldn't be in that spot. Again, I'm just reflecting what either the chairman themselves or those who have defended their actions have said.
Let me answer that. First of all, there were about 3,400 people who voted. I think 2,400 voted for Mr. Bill Assemblyman Nojay and 12 or 1,400 for Rick Milne. Given that there are 34,000 Republicans, that's about 10 to 12% of the vote. So the fact that robocalls were made really pumped up and in a way that played to people's true feelings. I'm sure people really felt badly. I certainly did feel badly about his death. So I think that that was unfair, number one. And number two, there was an opportunity to just let the election go forward. And number three, I was absolutely stunned when I heard this. I had met Assemblyman Nojay twice, ironically, the 2 days before. And I had studied his positions and his biography. I saw that he was a very bright man, et cetera. So when it happened, I felt a personal need just to stop campaigning so that people could sort of deal with that issue. It certainly wasn't appropriate to go knock on doors. That's what I felt. So I think Rick Milne did the same thing. So while Rick Milne had, and it didn't hurt me, but while Rick Milne, out of respect for a colleague, for an opponent, stopped campaigning, the bosses were making phone calls. So I didn't think that was appropriate.
Okay. Well, I think everyone agrees, no matter what you thought of the work of Bill Nojay and his career, whether you're a Republican or Democrat, a Green, Libertarian, or otherwise, you know, nobody wants to be in these circumstances again. That was a tragedy.
Absolutely.
And very difficult. But Joe, do you think going forward that process, we may never see it again. We all hope we don't ever see it again. But should the process change? Are you comfortable with being selected?
It's the law.
Okay.
So that's, you know.
But the law could change.
Yes. But I'm saying, so once, you know, if it does change, then fine. But at this point, that is the law. There's nothing wrong. And we always argue, and I probably would argue, that three men in a room, especially with the budget concerns, are not, it's not a good thing.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about with Barbara Bear and Joseph Arrigo, who are running for that seat that was held by Bill Nojay. And you heard Mr. Arrigo say that he essentially recruited Bill and kind of convinced him to run for that seat when he retired in 2010. If he's elected, he will go back and serve after serving five terms from 2000 to 2010. Barbara Bear, this would be her first term. If, listener, you want to call the program, you can do that toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you are in Rochester, 263-9994. A little bit on their background. Joe, before 2000, when you were in the Assembly, let our listeners know, again, more of your work and career and your background.
Well, just a short resume. I'm a husband, father, grandfather, and a Marine Corps veteran. I served the state of New York for over 30 years as an official court reporter. I was in Supreme Court, County Court, Family Court. I was appointed as Livingston County Commissioner to the Rochester-Genesee Regional Transportation Authority with a $42 million budget and served more than 14 million people, you know, a year. Elected and proudly served as an assemblyman for 10 years. While in the Assembly, I served on the Nursing Shortage Task Force to resolve the nursing shortage that was happening in 2001 and 2002. I was successful in getting the Women's Health and Wellness Act passed, which made breast and cervical cancer screening available to more women than ever before and put an end to insurance companies unfairly denying coverage and screening by closing legal loopholes. As the ranking minority member of Children and Families, I had a bill passed into law requiring local districts to provide crisis intervention for exploited children. And that's a law that I'm really proud of, because every year, people don't realize that approximately 18,000 children are brought into this country and exploited using, you know, prostitution, you know, by unscrupulous people. So, you know, I'm on that bill, and I'm proud of that.
All right, that's some of his background. We'll talk about what Joe thinks his priorities would be if he is elected. Barbara, some of your background for listeners who may not know you.
I graduated from the University of Rochester and moved to New York City and got involved in government. I was first involved in politics, and at the time I was a Republican. I was a Rockefeller, Lindsay Republican, and the city was changing and vibrant. And I later changed to the Democratic Party, but meantime I served in the state and in the city in a variety of public servant positions. But I believed in public service as a mission to make a difference in the world. I believe in government as a way to make a difference in people's lives. And I became involved early on in working with seniors, and did a huge nursing home investigation statewide, which really changed the way at that time that nursing homes did business. There's still unfinished business, and we can talk about that later. But it really looked at the quality of service, the politics of it, and the way that the Medicaid formula was designed. And ultimately, out of that investigation became a Medicaid ombudsman, a Medicaid inspector, better care, a patient's bill of rights, and some changing of the formula. So that was something that really made me aware of the needs of seniors, and I followed that with doing some work on something called EPIC, which is the drug, a senior bill to help at a state level seniors pay less for drugs. And I did a lot of constituent work and a lot of work with mental health. So along the way, I adopted two children out of foster care, Tommy, who was 10, Shane, who was 13. They're now 27 and 34. They're doing well. I was a single parent. It was a long and hard march, and I certainly became aware of the foster care system and the idiosyncratic problems, and I certainly would want to change some of them if I got there. And ultimately, after my last gig, so to speak, with a public official who was running for mayor but lost, I went to two not-for-profits, and I worked a lot as a government relations person. That means in the not-for-profit world, a lobbyist. I worked on lobbying Albany on bills that would help affordable housing go forward, 421A and a couple of other bills where the affordable housing industry would get tax exemptions to build. So after that, I decided to move back to Pittsburgh, found a partner, decided that my life in New York had finished, and I came back here about 3 or 4 years ago. I was Sandy Frankel's campaign manager. Wished I could have done a little better. She would have been great. And that's no disrespect to Cheryl DeNoffo. I think she's doing her best. So when there was no one running, and at that time against Assemblyman Nojay, I volunteered because I thought that there should be a conversation about the issues and which way to go forward.
Okay. Priority one for you. If you're elected, Barbara, priority one for you going to Albany is what?
To change I think the ethics and corruption is really tainting all of state government. And the first thing I want to do is to really push for a law which would end the loopholes. The LLC loophole is called. It's basically this. If I have a corporation, the Barbara Bear Corporation, at the moment I can set up 10 subsidiaries, ABC, et cetera, and give a decent amount of money through each of those subsidiaries to a candidate. The amount of cash infusion is a disgrace in Albany for both parties, and it's unnecessary, and it really gives the voter, the individual, an unlevel playing field. In other words, you have lobbyists. It's not the lobbyists, it's the amount of money that they bring talking to elected officials, and you have the public having to do a rally in front of the state house, whereas the lobbyists can get in and also give a good amount of money.
So ethics reform is number one for you, and LLC reform at the top of that.
Yes.
Okay. Would you vote in favor of limits on outside income for legislators?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And in general...
But like, I want to say this. Okay. I'm perfectly happy with the salary as it is now. Some people have made a big campaign issue out of it one way or another. I think it is a complicated issue, and this is another... And I have no idea what my opponent stands, so it's not about
him.
Well,
you're about to find out, but okay.
Okay, but, but here's the point.
Sure.
For $79,000, some people can live well on that, and other people, that's not enough money. So I think we have to look at what the outside limitations would be. Having said that, and I'm a lawyer, there's no way that you should be in the assembly and also practicing law in anything that is near what is going on in the legislature, because that just smacks of too much sort of symbiotic relationship.
Well, and that's exactly what we saw with Sheldon Silver, which I know Joe Rigo was shocked to find out about. but Barbara, before I turn over to Joe on his priorities and ethics reform as well here, I do want to ask you if the governor from your own party, our governor, has said that he wanted ethics reform to be a priority going into office. He's on his second term now, and there is a lot of self-congratulations, but not a whole lot of ethics reform packages that look like they have real teeth here. Are you disappointed in him?
I don't have a judgment of him, but I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go really push. I'm an independent Democrat. Nobody drafted me. I knocked on doors, got the signatures.
You don't feel beholden?
I feel beholden to the constituents and no one else. And, I have respect for anybody who's the governor. But, no, I'm going there to make change.
Okay. Joe, for you, if you go back to the New York State Assembly, what is priority number one?
Well, again, to end that corruption, what I would do is say that if a legislator is corrupt, then we take away his pension. I mean, it's ridiculous that, they're corrupt and still get their pension. So that's
kind of a golden parachute.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, Barbara, how do you feel about that?
Oh, I totally agree.
Okay, so we got agreement there, Joe. When it comes to LLCs that you mentioned, do you that kind of a loophole? Do you feel that that is something that should be targeted?
Well, I'm not really understanding the loophole because lobbyists serve a purpose. They come in advocating for their clients, and they give you another perspective, or education wise, to the whole perspective. Now we're limited to I think less than $20 a day for a lobbyist, and I think it's even less than that. So I doubt very much if somebody's going to sell their soul for $20 or less. Right.
Okay. Well, no. Barbara, do you disagree?
No, let me. I think maybe I wasn't clear.
Okay. Go ahead.
I totally agree that no one's going to sell their soul for $20. And what I was saying was something different. For example, there's a company called Glenwood Management in New York who was pushing for a reform of the tax 421A, which is a tax reduction on housing. Well, their lobbyists were good, decent people, but it also came out that they were giving Sheldon Silver tens of thousands of dollars through their LLCs. So I don't mean the lobbyists. I mean the donations. So I myself was a little bit amused at my own stupidity or naivete, because I actually went up there for a not-for-profit and was lobbying on this 421 a bill, and I thought I had actually been very successful. Well, it turned out that maybe I was successful, but it turned out that this for-profit company was I'm sure they gave nearly $100,000 to at least one legislature, and they got the bill passed. So, you know, perhaps it was on my great skills, but I'm saying that, yeah, but I doubt it. And I kind of laughed at my own self. I think when I read how much money had been given about this bill, well, of course it made a difference. I mean, you know, we all know a lunch or a cup of coffee is not going to change anybody's mind. But when people get 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35,000, they certainly have to do, they certainly have to give access, and they certainly hope that they can go a certain way. So it's just too much money, and people, and campaigns cost money. So people need to not be so vulnerable. They, if they're not able to take it, then they won't take it.
All right, Joe?
Well, you know, I feel that, you know, I understand what Barbara's saying, but you're talking about unscrupulous people, Sheldon Silver, and, you know, people like that. And I remember, you know, before I left the assembly, there was a rash of corruption. I'm talking millions of dollars that people were taking. I'm talking about legislators. And it was uncovered, and they had to leave. My only thought is, and Barbara, you could, you know, help on this, that, you know, the salary is approximately $79,000. Yeah. And living in the New York City area, I mean, you can't survive. So I think that these people are influenced, you know, thinking that they can get away with, you know, this kind of corruption.
Sure. So should the salary go up, Joe?
Well, I'm satisfied with it. But, you know, if that changes the dynamics, yes.
Okay. Should outside income be limited or barred?
Well, I would say limited. Again, you know, how much money do you want to make? And then being in that position, you do have, you know, the authority to make things happen.
Okay.
No, I would say that I'd be satisfied with the $79,000.
How would you rate Governor Cuomo's work on ethics reform?
Well, not great. I mean, we talk about the monies that he says that you know, he saved on taxes and all these other things, but he neglects to tell you that the money is kind of hidden in the background through authorities. And when we hear that, you know, the governor saying that we're only behind about $53 billion, that's not true. We're down about $600 to $700 billion because of the monies that he's taking from the agencies, backdoor borrowing. You know, he doesn't give the voter the right, and it's a constitutional right, to vote on that. So a lot of this, you know, is just smoking, you know, mirrors. And so I don't think he's doing such a great job at this point.
All right. Before I grab some of your phone calls, anything you want to add there, Barbara?
Well, I think that the legislature needs to push the governor on ethics reform. And that I also think, and again, no disrespect to Assemblyman Arrigo, I also think that there should be term limits. I think 4 terms and you're out. So if he gets elected, I hope he only serves 4 terms. But
I'll hold you to that.
Okay. I just want to say I have a lot of friends up, not so many, but I have a number of friends in Albany who were elected, and they're making $79,000, and they're very honest. So when I talk about the corruption, it's limited to a certain number of people. And they, by the way, have sometimes been in for 20, 30 years. But I don't think that that's appropriate. I think it's too tempting. And I think a couple of terms in the institution, then you do the best you can. You have the best vision you can. You have the best advocacy and the best passion. And then you go do something else. It's not a lifetime appointment. So I think that ought to change. And by the way, the rules are so stacked for the incumbency that it's very hard for anybody to get elected. And that's why almost nobody beats an incumbent. There was there's a franking privilege of mailing. Well, people use that for all sorts of odd things. And I've promised that if I were elected, I would have one mailer a year which would explain my vote on the budget, up or down, what was good, what was bad, and why I did it. And I wouldn't pander to either one group or another. I would say, this is it. So if you don't like me, you know, next time a vote comes around, you'll ask me to leave Albany and put somebody else in. I think that's the way to do it, but give people a chance. There's too many people, and then there's too many legacies. There's too many people. There's not an open situation, and people to some extent are reluctant to get into public service for that reason.
Barbara, the issue of campaign mailers or constituent mailers, mm-hmm. which some people felt looked like campaign mailers, came up in the primary campaign between Harry Bronson and Rachel Barnhart. She said that he was abusing that. Do you feel that it is used almost as campaign mailers as opposed to actual constituent communication?
Well, I certainly don't want to comment on whether he was or was not. But what I am simply saying is that the mailer should go around at the budget time, and that should be it. Because basically, by dint of this franking privilege, you, as an incumbent, don't have to raise really tens of thousands of dollars to mail. So I think it should be really redone. There ought to be one mailing for the incumbent, explain the budget. By the way, the budget is a way for a member to bring some money home. By negotiating on the budget, you can figure out some of the things the district needs. You can sit on the Regional Economic Council and you can bring some bucks home. So that's what's most important for the constituency. And then from April 1st on, there are always a couple of bills, like kind of signature bills of the Assembly of Western New York, New York City, whatever, that can really be dealt with. And I saw that Bob Duffy had written an article a while ago that there should be a bipartisan Western New York coalition which would work together for Western New York. And I totally agree. I would work with everybody. I don't think the 133rd District, whomever gets elected, has gotten its fair share. And, you know, Pittsford has totally different needs than Livingston County, than Steuben. But the fact of the matter is, with these multiple identities in a district, there are needs. At the Regional Economic Development Council, Livingston, I think there were 30 grants. Livingston got one for the Finger Lakes. So nobody's really been advocating there. And in the budget, you know, last year, Mr. Nojay voted no on the budget. I disagree with that. There was a middle income tax cut there, the highest middle income tax cut in two decades. And we're always talking about tax cuts, and he voted against it. So I understand he had other issues. It wasn't that. But my judgment would have been to work with the majority and get something for the district and vote yes. And I am for tax cuts. I get it. We need to decrease taxes a bit. Well, we also need to help people. There's a lot in Livingston County that needs to be done. And there's lots of exciting things that could go on with some capital grants.
All right. Well, we're late for our only break. You're hearing from Barbara Baer, the Democrat. She's sitting alongside the Republican in this 133rd Assembly District race. That's Joe Arrigo. And we're going to get to your phone calls as well. So Kathy, John, Joel, other emails as well. The candidates in studio with us for the remainder of the hour. Let's get that short break and come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on the next Connections. First hour, the youth vote. Not good this year. At least that's what young voters are telling Gallup. Only 47% of voters age 18 to 34 say they definitely plan to vote on November 8th. Why? In our second hour, Screen Time for Kids, new guidelines and recommendations for what kids under 2 should be exposed to. Join us Friday.
Hey, thank you very much, and thank you, Evan, for the great programs that you always do.
Well, thanks.
So I'm particularly interested in gun violence. I read a good amount of the Attorney General from New York State, Eric Schneiderman's report, that was released just yesterday, and it has to do with a crime gun analysis for New York State. Specifically, he points out that in his report, you can look at county by county results having to do with crime gun activity, and at the conclusion, the Attorney General makes recommendations. So Monroe County, if I've read this report correctly, has the highest rate of low time to crime gun recoveries of all the counties in New York State. That means the low time to crime is the time from when a gun is sold to when that gun appears in a crime and is retrieved by the police. So we have the highest low time to crime gun recoveries of all the counties. That's not good. Usually it's an indicator that gun trafficking may be going on. Secondly, we have the highest per capita gun deaths in Monroe County. Of all the counties in New York State, we have 101 gun deaths per 100,000 people versus what the national gun death rate is, which is 82 per 100,000 people. Finally, Monroe County has the highest in-state contribution of crime guns recovered on the street. What that means is that rather than the majority of our crime guns coming from outside the state, the majority of our crime guns are coming from within the state, suggesting that either there's a large amount of theft contributing to the crime guns, in which case I'd like to know specifically what are these legislators going to do about that? Will they support a state safe gun storage law? Secondly, could that large in-state contribution have anything to do with perhaps a few minor bad actors of 5% of gun dealers who are repeatedly linked to 90% of the crime guns?
All right, Kathy, let me just jump in and give them a chance to respond. Thank you for that comments and questions. I'll start with Joe Arrigo. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, as far as, the guns, 82 per 100,000 people, you're talking about in the city of Rochester, and talking about crime guns within the state. The states, you come to Rochester, and with $100, you could buy a gun. And there are, different areas where there, crime is involved. That's all another way. I made an attempt to, before I left office, to talk to, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle. And, instead of holding the gun owners, the legal gun owners, to, a task, that we should work together and find out where the guns are coming from. Now, we had some good indication of where they're coming from. And in fact, just the other day I heard that Ohio and I think North Carolina were trafficking guns upstate. And now you have Philippines that are making guns, what they call a 1911-45 pistol, and they replicated that, and it's a great gun. However, they're selling it to illegal people. So and again, you're talking about if there's a gun dealer that is doing some of that, we'll shut them down.
Okay.
So that's what I would do.
Barbara?
Well, I think we're talking about a couple of issues here. One, I'm not running for county executive, and probably will not. But were I to, I would really push a really higher enforcement program of really trying to buy back guns at a much higher rate. I think that would be one thing. Two, with regard to the city, I think there has to be more policing, more money for policing, and more trying to get the guns away. Having said that, let's look at what you're talking about. You're really not talking about Monroe County. You're talking about Rochester. And we need to get to a point of view, and I would think that to some extent it would be aid from Albany, and I would be in favor of that if it would help. We need to get the violence down. We need to work on the poverty issue. We need to get the gangs into some other situation. And we really need to face the fact that not only is there high gun violence, but I think it's we have the third highest poverty rate for children in the nation. So when I tell anybody that, they're absolutely shocked because they remember Rochester during the Kodak era, and they can't believe that, A, there's been a decline in the population, and two, people have moved to the towns, which is a way of being safe. So, of course, part of the problem is economic development in Rochester, and that economic development is impeded by the fact that people frequently move out, and then they don't go back as much as they could. I can assure you we'd have a much more flourishing arts, theater, restaurant business, and more people moving back into the city if they really felt safe. You know, if you put the news on at 5 or 6 in the morning and read the paper, unfortunately, almost every day someone's being shot. I think that getting guns away would solve part of the problem, but I don't believe it will solve all of the problem.
Well, but I want to understand where the candidates may differ here. And we had an email from a listener named Joel who said that he thought Bill Nojay was the best defender he's seen of the Second Amendment, someone who was against the SAFE Act. First of all, Joel wanted to know if Mr. Arrigo would follow in those footsteps
in
the Assembly.
Yes. That's one of the...
You oppose the SAFE Act?
I oppose it, yes.
Is there any chance of repeal, or what would your plan be in office?
That was my next segment, that I will try to compromise. But here, again, you have the gun owners. They do everything according to the book. And I asked this question many years ago. How many crimes are committed by people that, have, let's say, are NRA members or, that type? I would submit that I don't know of any.
You don't know of any?
Of any. In other words, that
NRA members who've committed crimes with guns?
Yeah.
I
don't know.
Okay.
I'm saying.
Okay. But your point is you think it's a low percentage.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would again try to repeal or modify the SAFE Act.
Okay,
it's costing us $25 million a year for what? Again, that's the governor is just stuck on penalizing the gun owners.
All right, so Joel, it sounds like Mr. Arrigo would be very much in line with what Bill Nojay did in office in regards to the SAFE Act. Barbara, is this a place where you disagree?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
First, I would refer to the district attorneys of Monroe and specifically Livingston County and point out some of the net pluses with regard to the law in terms of the SAFE Act. Because there is a SAFE Act, the district attorney can ask for higher penalties on things like injuring a child with a firearm in terms of hurting someone who's an emergency responder, in terms of making a straw purchase, which basically means I buy it for you, but you're the one who's the criminal. So from a DA's point of view, there's a good reason to keep the SAFE Act.
For penalties after the fact.
Yeah, but
you mentioned shooting an emergency responder, and everybody, their head goes to West Webster.
Absolutely.
I don't mean to be sort of blunt or crass about this, but what Spengler did that night, he was not going to change his actions based on the penalties that would await him. That wouldn't have prevented that, would it?
No, it would not have. I totally agree. But let me make my second point.
Okay.
I have two sons. They live in the Catskills, Bethel. They both shoot. They're hunters. I have asked them whether they had any real issues in buying a gun. They had to pass the registry, and they shoot. And so I understand the cultural desire to shoot, and I respect it. And I don't think that the people who are shooting are the people who are basically the highest cohort of committing crimes.
Okay.
So that's number two. Number three, there was an issue, and I don't think this $25 million has been spent. There was an issue about the number of bullets that could be purchased. And basically, the governor and majority leader of the Senator Flanagan, have signed a memo of understanding that really basically de facto says nothing's going to be done. So I don't see that there's any irreparable harm to the people who want to shoot, hunt, like my sons, to actually have to pass some sort of test to make sure that they're okay. I think the issue always gets back to this. And the real issue is hunters can hunt. That's great. But there's violence in Rochester and New York City and Yonkers and across the country. So instead of actually sort of let's try to find some common ground to get the guns out of the kids' hands in Rochester or New York or any urban place. That's the real issue.
But give me one thing, and I know Joe wants to come back, but give me one thing, Barbara. You're talking about that. That's sort of an abstract. What's one thing that could be done to get those guns out of the hands of the people?
Well, I think the police have to be very aggressive. That's one. And buy back. There have to be more police on the streets, and they have to be aggressive in watching the kids. I'm not for stop and frisk, but I am for really trying to watch people on the street more and trying to get to anticipate where there might be some potential of violence. And it's also, of course, called the community policing. But, you know, there's not enough community policemen. I truly believe that if the amount of violence went down in Rochester, the economics would increase in a much quicker way.
Okay, Joe?
Well, I grew up in Rochester, and where I lived, I wouldn't go down there in an armored car, right? Because that's how dangerous it is.
Where you grew up, you mean?
Right on Carter Street.
Okay. Yep. I know that is, yep.
Yeah. Right near Hudson Avenue and then all that area. It was a beautiful area when I was growing up. However, like I say, I wouldn't go down there in a, you know, bulletproof car.
I'll take you down there sometime. I know the point, but I'll go down there. I'll take you down there.
Okay. As long as it's bulletproof, okay? Anyway, it's not, you know, with the police. I mean, these policemen are, you know, targets. And they're shot at, they're beaten. So I don't know what you're talking, Barb, about more police, and then they're categorized as a militia, all these different things. It's the mentality of the people that have to be changed. You know, be law abiding. If an officer stops you for some reason, then make sure you obey his command.
I certainly was not showing any disrespect to the police. I just don't think that there's enough of them. And to really have community policing in some of the areas. And by the way, we had a storefront in the Franco campaign on Lyle Avenue, and it was fine during the day. And at night, I agree, I might have worried, but I don't think we need an armed car. But I'm not showing any disrespect to the police. I think there's one important thing here, that the whole issue of poverty and disenfranchisement and economic inequality between our poorest people and our wealthy, to some extent, is playing out on the street between the police and the people who are most disenfranchised or poorest. And it's not fair to the police, and it's not fair to the people who are the victims of this. So
Joe, you're shaking your head.
It's, you know, again, we're always saying, you know, because they're poor, they react in such, you know, a type of way. And, again, when I was growing up, there was never a problem, not like it is today. You have drugs, you have all these different things coming into play, and they use it as an excuse.
But what causes that now, Joe? Why do you think that is happening today?
I'm saying because, you know, again, you know, if you teach your children one way, now, I know, listen, there are many, many good people, Hispanics, you know, black people. I have friends, and they're policemen, and they're afraid to go out on the streets. And, again, you have no respect for law officials. And it's number one. If the parents start teaching their children how to act with civility, maybe that'll help. But not to pick out that, well, because we're poor, you know, we act this way. My parents were very poor, and never did they ever tell me, you know, disrespect a teacher, any of these things. So just, you know, I just don't buy that.
Okay,
you
know? So quick response, Barbara, and I'm going to try to get a few more phone calls.
Yeah, what's interesting is that the SAFE Act has spurred this discussion. First, I think the Rochester police are doing a very good job, and they did in a couple of past instances. Second, I think they should be respected, and they needed more of them. Third, Joe, you and I are about the same age. We grew up at the same time. Mm-hmm. When we grew up, there was hope of a better life. There was not a television that's 24/7 that shows every kind of drug, sexual act, and any mm-hmm. other kind of perversion that exists. There were not games that you can buy, that you can shoot somebody and that's fun. So, I mean, whether I'm for it or against it, it's here. And I think that we have a whole different set of cultural values and norms that we have to deal with. So people who are poor are angrier. People who are of color who feel that they're being discriminated against are angrier. There's a whole sort of global new life where to really get ahead, you have to be educated. And even if you're educated, you don't necessarily get ahead. So I think that both Trump and Bernie Sanders caught on to what some of America is really feeling, which is a tremendous amount of economic pain. I don't necessarily agree with either of the way the two candidates expressed it. But even in the district which one of us or the other will represent, there's a good amount of economic pain. And that's a problem that we're really not addressing. So,
but Barbara, you touched on racial lines. Joe, yeah. Do you think non-white Americans are treated differently?
No. I think they take that attitude because it's given to them. You know, I mean, when you hear the president's minister say, instead of God bless America, God damn America, let them feel the pain. Now you're bringing this back to slavery. And I was not part of that. My parents weren't part of it. You know, we lost a lot of people over that fight. But I think the president has done a disservice. And, I don't condone. And I hear the way he talks sometimes that just... They're telling the black people, get out there, kill them, kill the whites. So,
Barbara, do you think non-white people are treated differently in this
Absolutely.
Country?
Absolutely, yes, I do, and I think I would disagree with all that Joe has said. I think this president's been extraordinary in trying to reach out to everybody. His choice of words, the way he's lived his life, the way the family has lived their life, is whatever color, it's a model that should be used by whomever wins the White House on both sides.
All right. So this is a place where they disagree. We're running out of time real briefly here. Upstate Economic Development, Joe Arrigo, were you comfortable with the $500 million pots that were awarded? And would you continue to sort of support that kind of development, some of the initiatives that have sprung forth from that?
Well, yes. I mean, this was the Rochester was an economic, hub. I remember all those years. And, if it's, again, used right, I have no problem.
Okay. Barbara?
Yes, but I want to get more for our district.
Okay. When it comes to environment, we got a couple of people wanted to talk that. So Marion Menden, got to make it quick. Go ahead, Mary.
Oh, yes. I'd like very much to know where our candidates stand on climate change. It's certainly important to all of us. Our farmers in Livingston County have been suffering with drought in so many seasons, and also how related issues such as fracking and the effects of the oil industry on climate change.
Okay. Mary, thank you. First of all, Barbara, real briefly, because we got to be tight on time, you brought up climate change in an interview with Capital Tonight. Why do you think that matters for a state legislator? Go ahead.
Because there are bills that one can vote on that would help climate change. For example, there's a bill in the Assembly that would allow the Assembly to create a whole committee to study how all parts of government and all kinds of employers could work together to make effects that would help us with global warming. I think the global warming is one of the existential threats of our country and the world and for our children.
So the state has a role.
Yes.
And you oppose fracking? Or
I oppose fracking.
Okay. Joe, fracking, for it or against
it? No, I'm for it. And again, Barb, you talk about global warming. They just found out that the university in England made this all up, that they took $11 million for themselves.
Made up what?
Made up the story. Global warming. There's no global warming. That was on the news.
I promise you, Joe.
There's climate change. I agree with that.
Yes, and the change in the climate is that it's getting significantly warmer. I promise you that.
Yes.
That's probably a whole other show, I guess.
Yeah,
but,
well, okay.
But the bottom line is, if you're elected, you don't view climate change as an issue for the state.
Well, I do. I mean, only because, you know, again, the farmers, I noticed the climate change. You know, my pond was 10 foot deep. You know, now it's down to about 2 foot. So, yes. But climate change has been going on for many, many
All
years.
Right, so you think we're in a natural cycle of variation?
I do.
Man not impacting climate.
I do.
Okay. And you favor fracking? You'd like to see us pursue it?
Yes, but the governor killed that.
That's right. But do you think that door could reopen at any point?
Well, he threw it in the lap of the his commissioner on environment, and I doubt it.
That it comes back here.
That it comes back.
Let me ask both of you, if you're elected, will you come back here and continue these conversations with our listeners? I know they appreciate it. Joe Rigo?
Yes.
Absolutely.
And Joe is someone who I knew in his previous 10 years, 2000 to 2010. We saw him a lot. If you're elected, we'll see you again. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
It's Joe Rigo is the Republican. Barbara, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
The Democrat in the race, mm-hmm. And we appreciate your time as well. The election is November 8th. They're running in the 133rd district in the New York State Assembly, of course, following the tragic death of the incumbent, Bill Nojay. Thanks for listening on this afternoon. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack as the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon, and we're right back here on Friday.